My name is Stephen Connor. I'm Grace II Professor of English in the University of Cambridge and a Fellow of Peterhouse. The aim with any kind of doll is to create something animate but capable of being animatable. This is why a doll is always different from a statue or a painting, from a representation, because the point of a doll is that it can be made to seem not to be a doll. And although dolls are silent, they have throughout history been thought to be capable of speech, or people have wanted to play with the possibility that they are capable of speech. So the history of ventriloquism, which actually only in the late 19th century, middle to late 19th century, became focused on the figure of the speaking doll, actually in early centuries there are quite a lot of speaking figures through whom voices were projected. So there's a certain quality to the silence and the stillness of a doll, which is that they seem incipient with life, with the possibility of movement and articulation. The sex doll is a particularly extreme and emphatic version of the silenced or subjugated object. I mean, an artist's mannequin or a dressmaker's mannequin is compliant, you can do things with it, but it isn't subjugated in the same way, in the sense that it doesn't seem as though it has been deliberately muted. And in the picture of the very earliest sex dolls, the very crude inflatable sex dolls, which were often equipped with a very large round mouth, and the purpose of that mouth is perfectly clear, is to receive a male sex organ, not in order to speak. So it's almost as though it's kind of doubly silenced by that act. It's muted, it can't speak, and even if it could, as it were, its mouth would be full. So there is something absolutely emphatic about that silencing and subduing of the sex doll. And yet, there is also something disturbing in that. And I think that what may be disturbing in that is precisely the fact that dolls are animatable, that dolls seem, as it were, as though they might be capable of a kind of speech, unlike a picture. And for that reason, it seems as though in some ways the doll will never be quite as compliant, quite as objectified or absolutely obedient as we might tend to think. And it's for this reason, I think, that dolls represent a certain kind of resistance, that there's actually a kind of resistance in their very absolute availability, because precisely the doll cannot consent, cannot be forced. Only living creatures can be forced. So there is a certain kind of obduracy, something that cannot ever in fact be overcome in the doll. This may well in itself be a source of a certain kind of arousal, I suppose, but it's certainly a source of a great ambivalence in the history of eroticized dolls and statues. I think that this resistance of the doll emerges in a history of what we might call effigial contagion. And I mean by that a certain kind of passing across or transfer of the quality of the doll or the effigy from the object to the subject, from the doll or the statue or the idol to the person using it. I mean by that that precisely because one is engaging in sexual relations with something that cannot possibly engage in sexual relations, one is in that very process oneself objectified. The sexuality that seems in some sense to be part of the subduing subjective life, seems to be on the life side of the encounter, comes to seem mechanical. And not only mechanical, but that particular effect of the mechanical that Henri Bergson says produces the comical. The sex doll in particular seems to produce a kind of, as it seems to me, a sort of dummying of the person using the sex doll. Nobody could use a sex doll and retain their dignity. It's not a kind of public action. Or rather, it can be a public action, but it is employed for almost entirely for purposes of comic diminishment. That is the function nowadays of that particular kind of sex doll that was characteristic of the 1970s, the inflatable doll. And I think this may have something to do with the fact that the inflatable doll is actually so fragile and so seemingly ill-suited for its purpose. Sex dolls are used as kind of athletic lilos or lifesavers in a rather curious event that takes place on a river in St. Petersburg, in which people whitewater raft down the river using blow-up sex dolls. But here again, the function is plainly to be ridiculous rather than in any sense to be arousing. I do think that things change or have started to change in the last 15 years or 20 years or so, when the materials and the techniques used to produce sex dolls have become much more sophisticated. These dolls are much less likely to seem absurd or ludicrous. And the fact that they are less likely to seem absurd or ludicrous is perhaps the reason why we are beginning to see what I think is a new phase in the relation to erotic dolls or effigies, namely a strong wish to identify with them. The practices of what are called living dolls involve people not engaging with dolls, but seeking to become them, dressing up, using prostheses, using very, very realistic latex masks in order yourself to become the doll. Now that seems to me to be something, it seems to be something very different from the subduing of a sexual object, you know, turning a person into an object for sexual purposes. If you're turning yourself into the object, it seems to me to be something different. And perhaps that turning yourself into the object is in fact part of that long collusion that takes place, that crossing over of qualities between the animate and the inanimate, that may very well in fact have a larger part to play in what we call sexuality than we might have suspected. So in a way, this is a reverse of the Pinocchio desire, the desire to be a real boy. It's the desire to be unreal, or to have that particular quality of being not alive or not dead, of being undead, that the doll possesses. And I think that that's a sign of the force or the fascination of this figure that cannot be forced, because the only way to make it do anything is precisely by force. You know, it cannot consent. It will not ever be able to give its consent to anything you do with it. So there's a certain kind of impassioned impassiveness about that that is deeply fascinating. I don't think it's entirely new. I think that human beings have, in different ways, in different periods, seen this power. Maybe it's a kind of transfer of power from the fact that idols, as their names would suggest, the word comes from the Greek eidolon, that just means an image, but idols are venerated and worshipped. So it may very well be that those qualities of seemingly immortal rather than mortal stillness may seem attractive to mortal and temporarily failing creatures. There's something about that imperviousness that is attractive. And if one thinks about something as commonly seen as the person, quite often a young woman, who makes herself into a dead weight as they're being arrested during a demonstration or public event of some kind, so that they force the people carrying them to use the force of seeming to drag off a mere dead weight, there is always a certain kind of charge, a certain kind of force in that. And one can understand, therefore, why there might be, as we could call it, a puppet envy. The fashion in the early 18th century and later in the 18th century for tableau vivant, for people who would literally pose as statues, sometimes, but not always, for purposes of erotic display, may also be part of this. It's the desire to see people in the condition of statues, but also a desire to be in that condition, precisely because human beings have two overwhelming visual desires: the desire to see and the desire to be seen. We've heard a huge amount over the last 30 or 40 years since Laura Mulvey's essay about the gaze, we've heard a huge amount about voyeurism and the power of looking. But any parent knows that there's an equally powerful drive in human beings, especially young human beings, which is to be seen. The child who says, "Look at me, Dad. Dad, Dad, look at me. Look at me. Look at me, Dad." And that "look at me" is something that a statue, that power of attracting and capturing the eye, and therefore commanding the eye, is something that perhaps the statue or the doll seems to have. If one thinks about the dildo, which interestingly is a near anagram of the word idol, we have there a kind of miniaturized statue. I mean, in a way, you know, a dildo looks like a kind of little person, but only in a very rough and ready way. And there is, it seems to me, something arguably much more abstracting and objectifying about an object that really replicates only one function or one part of a human being, as opposed to an object that represents the whole human being. I don't think there are many accounts in existence in which dildos threaten to come to life. It might be rather attractive and interesting if they did, but dildos are pretty much entirely dead. They are really subdued to their purposes. I think that when you add a function, a specific function, to a doll or a representation, and the best example here is adding sound, adding voice, as in Thomas Edison's famous talking doll, which had a little phonograph inside it. When you add a function in a certain kind of way, it seems to me that you make it less capable of being animated. It's the opposite of what you might think. It becomes much more of a machine. It's got works. That's the point about a talking doll. My sister had one growing up in the 1960s, some 60 or 70 years after Edison's talking doll, and it was pretty much the same design. Actually had a little plastic gramophone inside it, just like the figure Hadali, who is created in Villiers de l'Isle Adam's The Future Eve in 1888. The voice here is a mechanical function. At that point, as I say, the whole thing becomes a sort of readable contrivance. You can take it apart and see where the soul is. The soul is in the gramophone. Somehow a doll that doesn't seem to have a soul has got more potential for animation, and that's precisely, of course, because it gets it from us. There is a theory that human beings have a very strongly anthropomorphic impulse, a strong impulse to see things as alive, as filled with intent, when they're not. And one can understand, actually, the evolutionary advantage of this. I mean, people who go around the place assuming that they are safe from tigers and predators and other kinds of agencies in the world are probably less likely to survive than very, very suspicious people who are more likely to see living things when they're not actually there. So it may be that we are very strongly predisposed to the idea that something may be alive, and that something that doesn't give us any evidence to stop us thinking that is more likely to pull off the trick of being animated. We do it ourselves when we succumb to the illusion of ventriloquism, which is thought to have something to do with the sense of sound, but is almost entirely a visual illusion. If you can't see the source of speech, you will find a source for that speech. And if you find anything that is halfway plausible, like a piece of wood shaped like a little boy or a little girl, then you will hear the speeches coming from that. That's how we hear the sound coming from a cinema screen. It's not coming from the screen, it's coming from speakers, often behind us. But we hear it from where we see it, because we seem, as it were, to be animation spotters. We are looking for signs of animation, and where we can't find it, we are quite likely to import it.